Kaiser, a bullet to the end zone. And it is a touchdown for Josh Gordon. His first since the 2014 season. And how about that? The inside pitch to Johnson, who tiptoes to the end zone, and the Brownies have the lead. Kaiser throws, and it is a touchdown for the Cleveland Browns, and that's Corey Coleman. And this is Davis in the 10. And now cuts it back the other way, and look out. Davis across the 20, the 30, the 40, across midfield with a punter to beat. And still on his feet all the way down to the Cleveland 25-yard line. They're going to throw it to the end zone. And it is a touchdown. Devontae Adams into the end zone. Devontae Adams money. Who has a dangerous throw. And it's a first down. And to the end zone. Devontae Adams and the Packers have won it in overtime.
It's unfortunate. Our guys, they fight hard. They do a lot of good things. And we do things that don't give us a chance to finish football games. You know, we started this game pretty well, did some good things defensively, offensively, moved the ball. I thought Deshaun early game played extremely well, did some really good things. Still some plays I'm sure he wish he had back. But then again, in the fourth quarter, you know, you just see when you need it the most, that's when you got to make plays in the National Football League, and that's what I told the football team.
Ebron and Phelps. Touchdown. Well, the Lions, after going 3-and-out, get into the end zone on their second drive. Theo Riddick. Winston moving to his right. Throws, and it's picked off. But the question is, did Slade get 2 feet down in bounds?
Great takeaway. A great young corner here in Detroit, Darius Slay.
On second and six, it's intercepted. There's the fourth Bucs turnover. It is picked off by Quandre Diggs. Winston under pressure, wrapped up, lost the football. Lions recover. That is the fifth Tampa Bay turnover. Theo Riddick. Riddick inside the 10. Still going. Touchdown. No timeouts for Tampa Bay. Now the clock winding down. That will do it. Jim Caldwell's Lions survive.
Got a lot of turnovers. Hit and ran to the ball and got tip balls and things of that nature, which were good. A lot of great effort. Gave up a few yards along the way. That's a team that doesn't give the ball away very often. Commend our defense for that. We hung in there.
16-member committee spent today reviewing a slate of 10 candidates whose career achievements were most significant during the era from 1970 until 1987. It's our first member of the Hall of Fame class of 2018, pitched from 1977 till 1994, winning 254 games for the Tigers, with whom he spent 14 of his 18 seasons. So he was a 20-game winner on three occasions, and his 162 wins in the decade of the 80s led all major league pitchers. Jack Morris, welcome to Cooperstown. Our second member of the Hall of Fame class of 2018 spent all 20 seasons of his major league career in a Tigers uniform, helping to anchor the middle of the infield behind Jack Morris for the first 14 of them. Rock-solid shortstop who led by example, hit .285 lifetime, batting .300 or better in seven different seasons. Four gold gloves, three silver sluggers, six-time All-Star, played in one World Series, and when he did, he made a count, Greg, winning series MVP honors after hitting .450 with a pair of home runs and driving in six over five games. Alan Trammell, welcome to the Hall of Fame.
Part of me almost, you know, after the first couple years on the ballot, kind of sensed that if I'm going to make it, that's the way I'll make it. But it was still difficult to go through the 15-year process and then 3 years off the ballot to get to this point today. Time healed me. Time gave me peace. Time made me understand.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to Yon Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Hope you're having an outstanding start to your Monday. Can't be better for you than it is for Jack Morris and for Alan Trammell, a couple of longtime Tigers that have been longtime, according to most Tigers fans, I would say, slighted by the Hall of Fame voting committee, by the Baseball Writers Association of America. They finally get their due. I thought that was a really interesting comment there by Alan Trammell, talking about how he's made his peace with it after all of these years, 15 years of waiting, 3 years being off the ballot, finally getting it. He said he had already been, he had made peace with it. I guess I can't really say that another way. It is what it is. And then to have this come at this time, it's really got to be an amazing honor for him. Kush, I wasn't planning on starting baseball because, you know, obviously yesterday so much important football took place.
Right.
A lot of really important topics to talk about from the football field, but we do know the winter meetings are going on. We do know that Giancarlo Stanton, the home run king and the MVP of the National League, has now joined Aaron Judge in the lineup for the Yankees, so there's news there. A lot of people critical of Derek Jeter, who's now running the show down in Miami, saying he just gave his best player to his former team, his favorite team, the Yankees, just, you know, specifically like a backroom deal. So there's a lot of stuff to talk about there. But I've got to do this real quick. And then, of course, like I said, there's tons of NFL things I want to get into. But since we just played that clip, and we heard Jack Morris there at the end, and I was saying Trammell. I meant to say Morris.
Yeah, that was Morris at the end.
Excuse me. Yeah, Morris, who has been, you know, and he's going to go in a little bit as a controversial figure. The reason he didn't make it over the first 15 years, of course, is because the ERA, that was always his biggest, you know, downfall, if you want to call it that. He's going to have now the highest ERA of any pitcher, starting pitcher, in the Hall of Fame. And that was always, you know, what kind of kept him off of a lot of ballots, even though he was one of the most dominant big game pitchers of his era. And maybe any era. I mean, that takes a lot of, discussion there, I suppose, and research. But, what's amazing is you see Jack Morris going in and you see Alan Trammell going in. And for me, Jim, the first thing I thought of when Tram was announced was I thought of Omar Vizquel. Because Omar Vizquel is, well, statistically speaking, he is every bit the equal of Alan Trammell. In fact, he exceeds, if I'm not mistaken, the numbers of Alex Trammell, particularly when you add in the fielding percentages and the number of gold gloves and all of those kinds of things. Alan Trammell hit .285 for his career, and I want to say Omar Vizquel hit somewhere almost in that exact same ballpark. Somewhere around 280, 282, 285, 286, something like that. Alan Trammell.
Career 272, by the way, for Omar.
What did he hit?
272 for his career.
272, okay. Alan Trammell with 2,365 hits during his 20 years in baseball. Omar Vizquel came up just a hair shy of 3,000. He was, what, 20? What was it, Jim?
2887. I'm looking at his numbers right now.
So 113 away from 3,000. So he had about 600 more hits, about 600 more hits. And Alan Trammell, as we know, the tremendous defensive player he was, four-time gold glover, all with the Tigers, teaming with Lou Whitaker for one of the best double play combos in baseball history. But Tram, his four gold gloves are, I want to say, about nine shy of Omar Vizquel's, because didn't Omar Vizquel win about 13 of those things?
I got 12 by my count. I'm counting it right now.
Okay,
got 12.
I thought it was 13, but even if it's 12, you understand the point. About 600 more hits, about 8 or 9 more gold gloves. One of the probably right there with Ozzie Smith as the two greatest defensive shortstops in the history of the game. I think this bodes very well for Omar Vizquel. You know, a lot of people wonder if he's going to be a borderline candidate. He certainly won't be a first ballot.
Right. Yeah, he won't be. He won't be on the first ballot this year. Any Indians fans, get that out of your head right now.
No, absolutely not. But there's just a question of, is there room for a guy who was primarily defense and one of the greatest players at the most important position defensively in the infield, and one of probably the two best defenders ever at that spot, but who wasn't much of an offensive threat. When you add he has 600 more hits than a guy you just put in, talking about Tram, you just wonder if there isn't going to be room for him as well, sooner rather than later. Not first ballot, not saying that at all.
Yeah.
But I don't think this is a guy who has to wait Jack Morris time either. Jack Morris waited, maximum 15 years, and then he said he kind of made his peace 3 years after leaving the ballot, you know, to now get in. He just wasn't talking about it, wasn't thinking about it anymore. It is what it is, and he was ready to move on with his life. And then, bam, there it is. I don't think that's something Omar's going to have to worry about. I think he's going to go in, and I think Alan Trammell just paved the way. I really do.
Yeah, no, Alan Trammell getting in absolutely will help a guy like Omar Vizquel. My couple thoughts on this real quick. First, on the Tigers thing, you know, as someone who grew up an Indians fan, Bob, yeah, I never paid this debate much mind, but in my over a decade now living around here and exchanging with many Tigers fans over the years, I become a convert that they, you know, should get in at some point eventually. And of course, we should note that this is one of those new committees. Used to be a veterans committee.
Right.
Now they've broken it up by eras. This was the modern era, quote unquote. Guys like Dale Murphy and Simmons and some others were on that list, but only Trammell and Jack Morris made it. So I am happy for that. you know, highest ERA among starting pitchers in the Hall of Fame aside, you know, you can't talk about pitching in the 1980s without mentioning Jack Morris and what he did as a Tiger specifically during that time. So I'm happy to get that they're in. As for the Omar thing real quick, yeah, I'm agreeing with you. I think Trammell getting in will eventually help Omar, especially considering I've never personally compared him in the Hall of Fame argument to Trammell. I've compared him to the one he should be compared to, Ozzy, yeah, the Wizard of Oz. And quite frankly, Omar's offensive numbers for his career were vastly better than Ozzy's.
They sure were. And since we're doing this, Trammell's offensive numbers were vastly better as well. He was a much more powerful bat.
Yes, he was.
Trammell hit 185 home runs in his career. Omar Vizquel hit 80. So that's 100 more. You give him that. Trammell drove in 1,003 runs. Omar 951. So they're 50 apart on that. As I said, Omar has 600 more career hits, even though a lower batting average, 272 to 285. So, you know, Trammell has an edge, a slight to modest one, if you will, over Omar in terms of offense. But then when you add the offense of being nearly a 3,000-hit player, as Omar is with 2887, to the 12 or 13 gold gloves, I feel like, you know, these kinds of shortstops deserve a spot. I mean, quite frankly, you know, Alan Trammell's offense itself didn't get him in. Nobody is going into the Hall of Fame at 285 with 185 home runs and 1,003 RBIs. That's just not nearly enough to say I'm a Hall of Fame hitter. Alan Trammell's going in because of that combination of offense and defense, particularly with Lou Whitaker. And by the way, what about Lou now? We'll have to talk about that. Particularly because of the offense and the defense combination that Tram had, four-time gold glove, et cetera. So if we're doing that now, these shortstops who kind of predated the power shortstops, the Alex Rodriguez's and to a lesser extent the Jeters and Nomar Garcia Parra and that run of, you know, tremendously powerful shortstops doing great home run things as well. When we're talking about just the tremendous glove and the competent bat work, the get the base hit. And by the way, what's weird about that, when I say competent bat work, there was nobody who was worried when they would see Omar striding to the plate in the 90s in a playoff game. Nobody was saying, oh, God, here comes Omar. This is an out. Can't we just, you know, balk him. Please walk him so we can get to Manny or somebody. Nobody was saying that. Omar Vizquel was clutch in those playoff years in the 90s during that Indians mini dynasty that they had. He could be counted on to always get the hit or to move the guy over, to drive the sac fly, to whatever he had to do. He was never a big strikeout guy. Just had just, you know, tremendous plate discipline and did great things.
Also, forgotten about him.
Even though he was known as, you know, the 12 or 13 time, I don't know if I keep clinging to 13 on that, gold glove winner.
Yeah, and everybody also forgets he had quite a number of stolen bases. You know, we're not talking Kenny Lofton,
right,
Ricky Henderson type, but he was a proficient base stealer over the course of his career, too.
That's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. Now I look at it, I see only 11 gold gloves. So maybe I'm, oh, you know what it was? It was 11 because it was Ozzy that had 13.
That's right.
He's second all time.
Yes.
That's why. Okay, I knew 13 was in my head for a reason. So he had 13 gold gloves, did Ozzy Smith. Omar Vizquel had 11 of them in his illustrious career, along with all of the things that we just talked about. And you're right, by the way, about base stealing. He did some tremendous work on the base paths as well. He just was an influential, really, really influential piece of all of those Indians teams. So, anyway, congrats to Alan Trammell. I think this will really open the door for a guy like Omar. There's another one to compare him to. You know, like you said, Jim, I think the most direct comparison is to Ozzy. But if people didn't like that, now you look at, hey, they just let Tram in, and Tram was no bopper. You know, he wasn't a you know, massive power hitter or massive run producer or massive batting average guy. He didn't hit 313. He hit 285. It was the combo. It was the combo of Alan Trammell, offense and defense, that rightfully earned him this spot in the Hall of Fame. And in the same way, I think Omar Vizquel's combination of skills, with the emphasis more on the defense, but that combination of skills will get him there eventually. So, and by the way, how many years has he been out? Would this year be his first year on the ballot?
For Omar, yes. Yeah, okay. Omar and Tommy, for that matter, first year on the ballot for both of them.
I will submit to you it is very, very likely that Omar Vizquel will be in before the next decade begins. before 2020.
I think a few things the next couple of years have to filter through. Sure, I can agree with that.
Yeah, I do. I really think that'll be the case. So anyway, congratulations to Alan Trammell and to Jack Morris. Big game, Jack. You know, that's all you can really say about him. You know, his overall stats aren't going to blow people away with that 3.9 or so ERA, but the big games that he played in and the force that he was when his teams, both the Tigers and the Twins, needed him to be a force, certainly, you know, deserved this consideration. And obviously, really, really, you know, unfortunate that he had to wait 18 years. But it is controversial because there are a lot of people who say, you know what, the numbers have to be better than that if you're going in with the greatest of all time. But he did get in, and congratulations to Jack and to Alan Trammell. All right. So we have that going for us, which is nice. But we have a lot of other things we have to get into today. Just to kind of set the table a little bit. Coming up at 4:10, we're going to talk a little college basketball. Sounds weird to say that. We have really kind of not focused a whole lot on college hoops, Kush, just because of the college football season.
Sure.
Playing the way that it did. But they're starting to get into...
Not to mention that college basketball, let's be fair. Most of us don't pay attention until near the end of February when we're trying to get our primers for the dance ready.
The regular season of college basketball, unlike the regular season of college football, just doesn't mean as much. I mean, until you look at the totals, until you look at the number of wins in your RPI when you get into February,
right,
like we're talking about. For now, as we know, if, you know, teams lose, it's like, okay, so they lost. It's like the NBA, really. Basketball's a different animal. They're going to play so many games. They're going to play for so long. And they have a long time to kind of build their resume before we get into start talking about tournament time. Same thing in the NBA. We pay attention to it, but it's not, you know, earth-breaking news when a team wins or loses a game in November or December because it's about, you know, what are they going to look like when it's, you know, when it's April. So having said all that, we will talk to Paul Keels about the Buckeyes and get a little bit of an update on Ohio State basketball, the voice of the Buckeyes, of course. And then at 4:35, we're going to talk to our friend Dennis Maniloff, who's going to talk about the Browns finding out their latest way to lose a football game. They are inventors, Jim. They are creators. They are pioneers. They find new ways to suck week after week after week, including blowing a 21-7 lead in the fourth quarter against a team being quarterbacked not by Aaron Rodgers, but a team being quarterbacked by Brett Hundley, and they still couldn't stop them. And they still couldn't stop a punt returner whose name I've already forgotten from returning 165 yards when all you needed was a good punt by Colquitt, which they got. Pin them down, make Brett Hundley go 70-some yards to try to find the tying touchdown, and instead they gave up 65 on the punt return. And the rest, of course, is history. We get the touchdown, overtime, interception from Kizer. And a lot of people are going to be very hard on Kizer. I'm not, because there were so many other components to the breakdown as the Browns fell to 0-13 than just Deshaun Kizer's really boneheaded mistake at the end of the game. Obviously, in the overtime, it was really, really crazy to not eat that ball and to throw it up for grabs the way that he did. But that was not the only play that caused them to lose when they had a 21-7 lead. A bunch of guys wet the bed. And to me, Kizer should not be taking all of the heat for that. But we'll talk about that with Maniloff. For this hour, we are going to talk about a lot of other NFL news, including the Lions, who are still hanging on. There's a possibility. It's not over yet, although I think a lot of people felt like when they were 500, 6-6 with four to play, it's going to be very, very tough for them to make the playoffs in a very crowded NFC field. But here we are. Here we sit. You know, they're 7-6 now. It wasn't a pretty win. Wasn't an easy win, but it was a win. Another Matthew Stafford fourth quarter drive to give the Lions a win over the Buccaneers. And now they're 7-6. They're still on the outside looking in. If they were there today, they would not be in the playoffs if they were to begin today. But a very soft schedule down the stretch gives them the possibility. Well, let's rephrase. How soft is it now that you consider that the Chicago Bears found something in quarterback Mitch Trubisky? The really questionable and often mocked first pick of the draft, Mitchell Trubisky, suddenly looks like an NFL quarterback. In the last two games he has started, Mitch Trubisky has a quarterback rating combined of 114. He was pinpoint accurate yesterday in a Bears win, and you might call a shocking win just because of the margin of victory over Cincinnati at 33-7. And he will be up next for Matthew Stafford and the Lions. Then Cincinnati, who I think has just completely given up. And I think Marvin Lewis is finally, after, 14 years of mediocrity and never winning a playoff game, is finally going to be shown the door when this is over. But then we get back to what we have been assuming would be a much easier victory or a much easier game to try to win, the season finale for the Lions at Ford Field against the Packers because, well, it's Brett Hundley and it's not Aaron Rodgers. However, thanks to that Browns collapse that gave, well, you can't say it gave Green Bay a victory, but thanks to that Browns collapse and that Green Bay victory, the Packers are right now back in the thick of things, also at 7-6. And since they are now in the thick of things for the playoffs, as much as the Lions or anybody else is, Aaron Rodgers may very well return next week. And if Aaron Rodgers is back, we all know it is a game changer. Hell, it could be a conference changer, to be quite honest with you, if he's back and fully healthy, recovering from that broken collarbone. So Aaron Rodgers suddenly changes it for everybody. The Browns got Hundley, and that might be the last team that has to face Brett Hundley. Now they might have to deal with Aaron Rodgers. So that could change things as well. So we'll talk about the Lions' chances on the way down the stretch. What's your thoughts on that, by the way? At 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. Also want to talk a little bit about Eric Ebron, who pretty much is just, he had a big day. Career highs in catches and yards, 10 catches, 94 yards in the win over the Buccaneers, and still isn't really thrilled about his precarious situation because he says the fans are never going to like him. The fans are never going to accept him. He basically says there's nothing that he can do to make this fan base happy. So it looks like the departure eventually of Eric Ebron is just getting, you know, more and more obvious by the week, whether he drops a pass and therefore incurs more of the fans' wrath, or he has a big day and just doesn't feel respected or appreciated for it. It's just not a comfortable thing. But they got to be glad they had him there yesterday because he was a big, big part of that Lions win. So we're going to talk about the Lions. We're going to talk a little bit about Tom Savage, the quarterback for the Houston Texans, who was the source of some controversy as he was concussed during the game. It looked like he was in a bit of a seizure with his hands twitching on live television. He was evaluated on the sideline and told he could go back in. It got a lot of people very upset. We're going to talk about that. Seattle, diving at the knees, the biggest punks in football, worse than the Cowboys, worse than the Patriots and the other teams that you may hate. The Seattle Seahawks. In a kneel down situation in Jacksonville where they lost, diving at offensive linemen's knees ostensibly to try to swipe the snap away and get one more shot at winning the game, getting thrown out, starting fights, and then somebody in the stands threw something at one of the Seattle players who tried to go into the stands after him. Cushlin, it was nearly malice at the Jacksonville Palace. It was nearly that. He was climbing and he was pulled down by an equipment guy who stopped him from going up. So we're going to talk about that controversial story as well. And the NFC is now up for grabs at the top of the division or of the conference because the potential, maybe, possibly would have been league MVP Carson Wentz is done for the year. All of that on the table for discussion today between now and 5 o'clock. Join us at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. We will get you a bottom-of-the-hour sports center coming your way after we get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, Wings, Beer, Sports.
With Giancarlo Stanton, now a Yankee, there is definitely some power in the Bronx. How much? Well, consider this. Last year, Stanton hit 59 home runs. Aaron Judge, 52. Gary Sanchez, 33. That's a total from just three players, 144 home runs. It's also more than a whole team hit last year. San Francisco Giants had 128. Now all three of those guys in the middle of the same lineup. That is a wild stat indeed. Your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Bottom of the hour, local sports center next. Come back with some of your phone calls and some really interesting NFL news as we continue on ESPN 106.5.
Ganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. We continue at 3:41. Thanks for joining us. Bob France here, Jim Cushland as well. If you want to be a part of the show, just dial the phone. It's pretty simple. 866-240-1065. We'll put you up and on the radio, 866-240-1065. And we have a lot of stuff to talk about. Hey, Cush, but, you know, I was just starting to get into some of the NFL stories, including the Lions, and we will.
Yeah.
But did you see what Amani Toomer had to say about Jim Harbaugh?
I missed that. No, I did not.
Amani Toomer, and gosh, I remember his time with Michigan because I believe he was paired at the same time with Mercury Hayes. They had a tremendous, tremendous passing game when Amani Toomer was with the Wolverines, and it was under Lloyd Carr, and he was a big-time star. And Amani Toomer, of course, went on to have a very nice career with the Giants mostly, I believe.
Yeah, Giants mostly. I forget where else he played, too.
Yeah, but he is now speaking out, and he's speaking out harshly in an interview with the Free Press in Detroit. Amani Toomer is calling out Jim Harbaugh for being a mediocre coach. He is ripping Harbaugh for mediocrity. He says he is not happy with Michigan football at all. Though head coach Jim Harbaugh, and this from the Free Press, has led the team to a 28-10 record over the past three seasons. And by the way, that's an average of what? About 9-3, right?
Yeah.
In three seasons, 28, because 9 times 3 would be 27. So a little over 9 wins, a little over 3 losses. So 9-3 average over his first three seasons, entering the Outback Bowl. Toomer, a former Michigan wide receiver, is not thrilled with the fact that he's 1-5 against Michigan State and Ohio State, the two chief rivals, and hasn't finished above third place in the Big Ten East Division in 3 years. So he was asked about Harbaugh over the weekend. Oh, you know, here it was. I apologize. This was in an interview with the Free Press. They just ran it. He was asked, Toomer was, about Harbaugh over the weekend at the College Football Hall of Fame as a possible candidate to become the next head coach of the New York Giants, another one of Toomer's former teams. And Toomer's response was harsh. He labeled Harbaugh as a coach who, quote, hasn't won anywhere, end quote, particularly in big games, quote, I'm really upset at how Harbaugh's done at Michigan. He's 1-5 against Michigan State and Ohio State. Only beat Michigan State once last year. The rest of the times, it's a loss. I think that he has not performed as well as I thought he should. Hasn't turned the program around. I mean, him and Brady Hoke are neck and neck in record. Or maybe a game or two off. Holy cow. That isn't accurate, is it, Jim? I don't know exactly what Brady Hoke's record was, but that can't be accurate, I wouldn't think. So I'm going to see if you can find that for me, because I'd like to know exactly if that's true. If it is, that is really, really damning, to say the least. But Brady Hoke at Michigan, well, I'm going to have you find it.
I got 31-20 was Brady Hoke at Michigan.
31-20.
That's correct.
Jim Harbaugh is 28-9. That's not close, Amani. That is not close. 31-20 and 28-9. That's a big difference. He's three wins less for Harbaugh and 11 fewer losses. So, no. Brady Hoke and Jim Harbaugh did not perform similarly during their times thus far at Michigan. Harbaugh at 9-3. You know, here's the thing, Jim. You know, as bad as they were under Brady Hoke, as far as they had sunk out of the national, you know, conversation, as far as, you know, being one of the big-time college football powers of all time, you know, their star, you know, it's kind of like Nebraska. The stardom is just gone.
Sure.
As bad as it was, you know, when Jim Harbaugh came in and started going 9-3, 9-3, 9-3, everybody should be doing cartwheels over that because of what the records were under Brady Hoke. But the problem is that the three every year seem to continue to be Ohio State, Michigan State, and Penn State. Or, you know, close to it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, they've gone 2-7 against those three teams. So I understand his point, and that's why I asked a couple of Michigan writers the last week or two, well, really since Ohio State beat them again, you know, how do you evaluate Harbaugh ball thus far? Because I think everybody thought they got way better, way faster than anybody expected they would in year one. And they got really good last year, too, had a really good solid season, almost beat Ohio State, despite having, you know, still a lot of guys that Jim Harbaugh really didn't recruit. But this year, probably a step backwards because of all of the graduation losses, you know, 10 defenders, defensive starters, 7 offensive starters, et cetera, et cetera. So the 9-3, 9-3, 9-3, I'll take that. If I'm a Michigan fan, I'll take that in the first 3 years of Jim Harbaugh. It's just that you got to have some of the, you know, some of the games against Ohio State and Michigan State and Penn State be among the nines and not so many among the threes. And I think that would be a fair thing to say. Would you agree? All right, I'm going to assume you do agree. Toomer, let's see, Harbaugh 29-6. And oh, yeah, this is just an overall record, look at Jim Harbaugh's record in coaching altogether, because Toomer wasn't just ripping him for Michigan, by the way, performance at UM. Toomer was ripping him, saying he hasn't won anywhere. And here are some of the numbers. At San Diego, University of San Diego, Harbaugh was 29-6. That landed him the Stanford job. At Stanford, he was 29-21, including a 12-1 record in 2010, which kind of helped land him the 49ers job. And in the NFL with the 49ers, in 4 years, he was 44-19-1. So averaging 11 wins a year in the NFL, that's not too doggone bad, to be honest with you. That's actually pretty good. And he led them to the Super Bowl his second year and to the conference championship game another year. So Harbaugh has been very successful at most of the places he's been. I'm going to have to disagree with Amani Toomer in that regard. Toomer was there from 92 to 95, just kind of looking back. I told you, he was very good, and he was a big-time component of a very, very successful passing attack then. I want to say, wasn't that Elvis Gerbach? Was Gerbach there then? I'm trying to remember who his quarterback was when he and – no, because Gerbach threw to Desmond Howard. So this was the years right after that, I guess. Anyway, Toomer caught 138 passes for over 2,500 yards and 16 touchdowns at Michigan, and he said he has not been around the program since Harbaugh was hired. Quote, the fact that we are my – here's the quote. This is the one that might just rub a lot of Michigan fans the wrong way from one of their former players. Quote, the fact that we are mired in mediocrity and accepting it, that's not what I think of Michigan. I don't think of Michigan as an 8-3 team and being excited because we have Michael Jordan shoes. I don't care about the shoes. I don't care about going to Rome. I don't care about any of that stuff. We are an also-ran in the Big Ten, and it's a Big Ten now, and it's embarrassing, end quote. That's some pretty harsh stuff. That's some very harsh stuff from former Michigan receiver Amani Toomer.
And humorous posterity's sake, Elvis Gerbach was his quarterback his first year. Then it was Todd Collins, and his last year it was Greasy.
Okay, there you go. There you go. I thought it was right after the Gerbach era, so he was there his freshman year. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so if you're a Michigan fan and you want to respond to that, I'd like to hear it too. Do you agree with him? Is Michigan an also-ran in the Big Ten? Are they just a mediocre also-ran, and is Jim Harbaugh that disappointing through 3 years? I think it is fair to say that much of what Toomer said is inaccurate in terms he said he hasn't won anywhere, when he has won pretty much everywhere, and sometimes big, including the NFL. And he said that Brady Hoke and Jim Harbaugh's records were only a game or two apart, and that's not true. Harbaugh has lost 11 fewer games than Hoke did through similar times, and he has three more victories. Three fewer victories. So just a little nugget there if you're a Michigan fan. How do you feel about that at 866-240-1065?
I mean, he's not totally, totally wrong in Amani Toomer's comments, because we've had this type of discussion sort of before. You were just bringing it up.
He's wrong about the two major things that I just said, though.
True.
About Harbaugh hasn't won anywhere.
Yeah,
and
that's false.
His record is very close to Brady Hoke.
That's also false. Yeah, but the also-ran part... Yeah, you do have to kind of still think that until they can start beating the Michigan States, Penn States, and Ohio States.
Yeah.
I mean, that part I have to agree with on.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. I don't want to say pass. You know, you give them a pass on that because it's only 3 years in. I don't. But part of me wants to say, be patient.
Yeah.
Rome wasn't built in a day, and rebuilding what Brady Hoke broke isn't going to be done in a day either. You know, even in 3 years, you know, this is three seasons in, and you know what it's like. You know, his first class was a half of a class because of when he was hired, in terms of recruits. And so those guys would be what, sophomores now, if they were redshirted, presumably. His second class would be, you know, redshirt freshman now. And then, of course, his most recent class, most of them were redshirted. Guys like Dylan McCaffrey. So, you know, I want to see what he can build when he has his vision of the program and his types of players that he wants to recruit. And I think this coming year will be the real tell-all year. He absolutely needs to beat Ohio State or Michigan State or both. He absolutely needs to do that. He needs to go 2-1 at the bare minimum against the big three that he'll face, meaning Penn State, Michigan State, and Ohio State, in order to shut up some of those critics, I think. Now, whether that'll be enough for Monty Toomer or not, I don't know. But just I liked what Toomer said because it asks a question that I was asking last week, and it is fair to do. I'm just trying to be fair in the answering of that question as well. I'm trying to be fair to Jim Harbaugh. I think there are some things you can say he has not won the big games, but you can't say he is just like Brady Hoke, and you can't say he hasn't won anywhere, and that this isn't going to be something that's fixed eventually. It's just not being fixed fast enough for some people's taste.
My two cents on this, Bob, is we're coming into the fourth year, so, yeah, I completely agree with what you said. He has to somehow go 2-1 against Ohio State, Michigan State, Penn State. And then
I really feel like one of those two, Jim, has to be against Urban. And no disrespect to the in-state rivalry with Sparty, but, I mean,
at some point you need to stop the streaks of the Buckeyes that have been going on since Tressel took over a decade and a half ago.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. And it's just, boy, it's just imperative. You know, and they came so close last year. It's imperative that they do this, like you said, to stop the streak. And I'll be honest with you, to win some of the recruiting wars against Urban.
Yes.
Don't think for a second that when the likes of, you know, Mike Weber, who, you know, from Cass Tech up there in Detroit, who was, you know, all set to do Michigan and then went to Ohio State and then had some back and forth about whether he was changing his mind. Don't think that some of that isn't, you know, Ohio State is constantly
getting
the gold pants.
Oh, yeah.
And singing Carmen, Ohio after Michigan games. And by goodness, you know, Michigan hasn't had anything to celebrate for so many of these kids who are going to be seniors, you know, graduating seniors since they even entered high school. And maybe to some of them going back to junior high school. That head-to-head rivalry means a lot when you're recruiting this region of the country.
Yeah.
If you're Michigan and Ohio State, the top two teams, and of course there's Notre Dame to contend with too, and Sparty to a different degree. Harbaugh, if he wants to be able to sell these kids that it's better to come to Michigan than it is to go to Ohio State, he needs to beat Ohio State. He needs to beat Urban once in a while and say, look what we're building now.
And the second part of what I'm going to say is something you heard just now in the local Sports Center update a few minutes ago. If the transfer things, because of the sanctions at Mississippi, hold, there is that chance that Shea Patterson, who has announced that he is transferring to Michigan, could play in 2018. If that's your quarterback, Jim Harbaugh in Michigan, then yeah, that really puts an exclamation point on the first thing we just said, since at one point he was a five-star recruit, number one rated quarterback in the nation, and he's transferred to Michigan. The only question is, will the NCAA, because of the Mississippi sanctions, say, okay, waive transfer rule thing, you can play in 2018. If Shea Patterson's able to be Michigan's quarterback in 2018, that makes this situation even bigger because they have a big-time quarterback then.
I got mixed feelings on it. You know, when Jake Rudock transferred in out of Iowa, Harbaugh started him. When John O'Korn transferred in out of Houston, he didn't start him, but he gave him plenty of consideration. And then when Spate went down, that was the guy instead of one of the young guns. And now here it is again. At what point, if you're a four- or five-star quarterback recruit and Jim Harbaugh's in your living room, at what point do you believe him that he wants you to play for him? Because I'm looking, if I'm Brandon Peters, who got the snaps after O'Korn was so ineffective and getting destroyed, and is, you know, as a redshirt sophomore or a redshirt freshman, I mean, and then you got Dylan McCaffrey, who's a five-star guy himself, who's a true freshman. Those two guys were expected to battle it out to be the quarterback for the next 3 years. If Shea Patterson comes in and takes that job as a transfer, I mean, if you're a young quarterback in the Michigan program, you're out of there. You're out of there. And if you are a young recruit, and I know he's got some five-star quarterback recruits that have verbally committed already too, you're thinking, you know, he keeps saying it's, you know, I've got a chance to compete and play against other guys in my quarterback class or in my draft class, not draft, my recruiting class. And then he's going out there and taking upperclassmen from other places. I don't know how I feel about that. I want them and him to get the best player on the field, certainly. But it is kind of odd that he's got two extraordinarily highly rated quarterbacks on his roster in Peters and McCaffrey, and both of them might just lose their job to Shea Patterson from Ole Miss. So it is a really, really interesting thing there. Patterson, let's see here. Patterson was the fourth-ranked player in the 2016 class, as we know. He was the number one quarterback of the 2016 class, so we should point that out too. And he's a, you know, he's a great young, and he had a nice year for Ole Miss. What was it, 2000? I had his numbers here a moment ago. Let me see if I can still find them. He threw for 2,259 yards, completed 64% of his passes, 17 touchdowns, and 9 picks at Ole Miss last season. Cut short after 7 games was the season. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's an interesting prospect, no question about it. It's a very interesting prospect, but I just, I feel kind of weird about those other guys. I feel weird about, Peters and McCaffrey about whether they're going to get their shots. It's a big question mark, and I'm not sure how to handle that. If I'm Jim Harbaugh.
Right.
I kind of have to know that my credibility in parents' living rooms is going to start to be shot if you keep recruiting all of these big time, you know, 4- and 5-star quarterbacks and say you can come and play in Michigan and then blow them off every time a transfer wants to come in because he seems to value the experience more than he does the upside of young guys. I just find that really, really tough, you know, going forward for Harbaugh.
Fair enough. I kind of agree with what you're saying, and yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out. I just find that an interesting factoid that just got dropped today on this whole conversation, if you will.
Yeah, and he tweeted it 3 hours ago. Thank you to the wonderful people, teammates, and coaches. Talking about Patterson, by the way, not Harbaugh. Thank you to the wonderful people, teammates, and coaches at Ole Miss. It is a special place, and I will always have great memories of my experiences in Oxford. I'm now excited to announce my commitment to continue my athletic and academic career at the University of Michigan. It's time to go to work. Hashtag go blue. So, yeah, there it is. It is an interesting thing, and he's going to have a wealth of talent at the quarterback position. What is Patterson? Is he a sophomore, or is he a junior, Jim, coming in?
I'm checking that out, but I think he's a sophomore just based on
you. Because he was the number one ranked quarterback in the class of 2016. So
yes.
That's right. So that would have been, so he'd be a sophomore. So that's a ton of talent you have at the quarterback position with guys like Patterson and McCaffrey and Peters. And then, like I said, I know there's a couple of other guys that I've seen recruiting factoids for Michigan who have verbally committed as well, who are 4- and 5-star prospects as well. I don't know how Harbaugh's going to figure that out. You can never have too many good quarterbacks, I suppose. But, like I said, when you've got guys who have been waiting patiently, then they find, how would you like to be, Peters or Dylan McCaffrey? You just find out that Wilton Spate, who was supposed to be the starter this year after being the starter last year, is transferring. And now the quarterback, and O'Korn is graduating. The quarterback job is wide open. Peters and McCaffrey, shake hands, may the best man win. This is going to be great. And now you find out, here comes a guy who's the same age as we are, essentially. Peters a redshirt freshman, and McCaffrey a true freshman. So he's going to have 3 years of eligibility left, too. And he played last year in the SEC and threw for 2,300 yards and completed 64% of his passes. Now it's a much bigger fight. So, not exactly sure, you know, how this is all going to shake out, but I think it might be tough going forward for Jim Harbaugh. Okay, I know we got to get out. It's 4:00. We'll get a quick timeout for a top of the hour Sports Center, and then ironically, we're going to go from Michigan talk to Ohio State talk, and from one sport to another. Paul Keels, the voice of the Buckeyes, will join us coming up next as we talk a little bit of Ohio State and Big Ten basketball. Then we'll talk a little more football and NFL style coming up after 4:30, right here on ESPN 106.5.
Kaiser, a bullet to the end zone, and it is a touchdown for Josh Gordon, his first since the 2014 season. And how about that? The inside pitch to Johnson, who tiptoes to the end zone, and the Brownies have the lead. Kaiser throws, and it is a touchdown for the Cleveland Browns, and that's Corey Coleman. And this is Davis in the 10. And now cuts it back the other way, and look out. Davis across it, 20 to 30, the 40, across midfield with a punter to beat, and still on his feet all the way down to the Cleveland 25-yard line. They're going to throw it to the end zone, and it is a touchdown. Devontae Adams into the end zone. Devontae Adams, money. Who has a dangerous throw, and it's a first down, and to the end zone. Devontae Adams and the Packers have won it in overtime.
Ebron and Phelps, touchdown. Well, the Lions, after going three and out, get into the end zone on their second drive. Theo Riddick. Winston moving to his right, throws, and it's picked off, but the question is, did Slade get 2 feet down in bounds?
Great takeaway, a great young corner here in Detroit, Darius Slay.
On second and six, it's intercepted. There's the fourth Bucs turnover. It is picked off by Quandre Diggs. Winston under pressure, wrapped up, lost the football. Lions recover, that is the fifth Tampa Bay turnover. Theo Riddick. Riddick inside the 10, still going, touchdown. No timeouts for Tampa Bay, so the clock winding down. That will do it. Jim Caldwell's Lions survive.
16-member committee spent today reviewing a slate of 10 candidates whose career achievements were most significant during the era from 1970 until 1987. It's our first member of the Hall of Fame class of 2018, pitched from 1977 till 1994, winning 254 games for the Tigers, with whom he spent 14 of his 18 seasons. So he was a 20-game winner on three occasions, and his 162 wins in the decade of the 80s led all major league pitchers. Jack Morris, welcome to Cooperstown. Our second member of the Hall of Fame class of 2018 spent all 20 seasons of his major league career in a Tigers uniform, helping to anchor the middle of the infield behind Jack Morris for the first 14 of them. Rock solid shortstop who led by example, hit .285 lifetime, batting .300 or better in seven different seasons. Four gold gloves, three silver sluggers, six-time All-Star, played in one World Series, and when he did, he made a count, Greg, winning series MVP honors after hitting .450 with a pair of home runs and driving in six over five games. Alan Trammell, welcome to the Hall of Fame.
Part of me almost, you know, after the first couple years on the ballot, kind of sense that if I'm going to make it, that's the way I'll make it. But it was still difficult to go through the 15-year process and then 3 years off the ballot to get to this point today. Time healed me. Time gave me peace. Time made me understand.
We just knew going into the game, you know, we had talked about them shooting 47% from three. That's through eight games. We just knew we had to be able to take away some of their three-point attempts as much as anything, and we were able to do that, and I think that allowed our offense to get moving.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on, we are at 13 minutes after 4. Thanks for joining us on this Monday afternoon edition of the Extravaganza. We'll get back to football coming up in about 25 minutes or so. Dennis Maniloff will join us with some NFL discussion. But now we want to turn our attention to the hardwood. Although, ironically, the last time you heard somebody talking about Ohio State's offense, it probably was going to include the name of J.T. Barrett or J.K. Dobbins. But we're talking about a different kind of offense now. And do focus on Ohio State basketball. And the voice of the Buckeyes, once again, is Paul Keels. And he joins us to break it down. Hey, Paul, how are you?
I'm doing good, Bob. How you doing?
I'm great. Hope you had a nice weekend. Thanks for spending some time with us. And you know, before we start talking about actual X's and O's and stats and results and everything else, Jim and I brought this up last week, and I'm sure you did too in your own conversations. What do you make of the oddity of, you know, interrupting the non-conference schedule with a couple of conference games and then getting back into non-conference games again before the actual full Big Ten schedule starts after the first of the year? Is that... It just strikes me as odd. It seems like an unusual way of doing things. What was the reason behind that scheduling?
Well, because the Big Ten tournament is... Oh, excuse me.
I think we're okay, Paul. Well, maybe not. I hear it a little bit more there.
We okay?
Yeah, I think let's give it a shot. We should be okay, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, because the Big Ten tournament this year is going to be a week earlier than it normally is. It's going to be in Madison Square Garden in New York, and because of the Big East having been grandfathered into that usual week, the conference season has been compressed, so that's why it happened. Now, and it is a little different, it's a little strange. Now, next year, when they expand to playing 18 conference games, then I think, from what I understand, then the first week of December, we're going to start to see Big Ten games occurring. And it might, I don't know if they're going to still slip in some non-conference games at the end of December or not, but it's something that we're probably going to have to get used to a little bit. It is a little, I think what was really screwy was the fact that Ohio State and Wisconsin played a week ago Saturday in the afternoon in Madison, the same day that the two schools were playing in the football championship game. And it made for a quick turnaround because then they had to turn around and play Michigan at home on Monday. And it was quick for everybody. So it'll be interesting to see how they map that out next year. But that's why it happened this year, Bob.
Well, I'm glad. I knew I was asking the right guy, and I'm glad I did ask because it is a little odd. I don't know if there's anything wrong with it. It's just not what we're used to, that's all. So, and let's talk about that quick turnaround. It was a quick turnaround for you, too, and it was successful for them. As a matter of fact, you know, three wins in a row after losing three out of four. You know, they were in a bit of a bad run there against some decent teams, too, when they lost to Gonzaga, Butler, and Clemson, wrapped around a victory over Stanford. But 2-0, you know, you won the two big ones, if you will, Big Ten games against Wisconsin and Michigan before William and Mary. And so, you know, it's a nice way to rebound from that little lag that they had.
Oh, I think so, especially given the fact that the two losses they had prior to that both involved with Butler and Clemson blowing double-digit leads. And then the Michigan game, they came from 20 points down to win. And, you know, this is a team that, you know, I think we were all kind of curious to see, you know, the new coaching staff, the influence they would have, what difference a healthy Kata Bates-Diop makes, and that's been a significant one. How much Caleb Wesson as a freshman would really be able to contribute, and that's been significant at this point. But also a team that really has some depth issues at the point guard position, and C.J. Jackson, who was the returning starter at point guard, has been a real offensive plus, but he was having some turnover issues. Lately, that seemed to have smoothed out. And Andrew Dockett, who's the graduate transfer who played last year in Michigan, had a career-high 8 points on Wednesday, on Saturday. And he's a guy that really isn't going to be asked to do an awful lot for him. So it's a team that's got – they're handicapped in some areas. And then they were playing minus two players that they would normally have because of injuries Saturday. So it's really been interesting to see how they've kind of grown under Chris Holt.
We're talking to Paul Keels, a little bit of Ohio State basketball, Big Ten basketball here in this middle portion of December. Already some Big Ten games played. Normally those wouldn't happen until after the first of the year. And Paul, our friend Jim Cushlin is here as well. He's got a question for you.
Yeah, let's start by going back to last Monday, the basketball version of the game. And what an outstanding second half from the Buckeyes this one. I mean, 41-19 to outscore what is still a very decent Michigan team. You got 18 from Kata Bates-Diop, 14 from Jayshon Tate. I love C.J. Jackson, 17-6-4, you know, off the bench in that one. Just an outstanding second half. What is it that the Buckeyes did so well in that second half a week ago?
I think a big thing was, Jim, their perimeter defense. And, you know, as we've known under John Beilein, Michigan is a team that really has fallen in love with shooting three-point baskets and have been very successful. And I think Ohio State held them to maybe something like 1-for-12 from three-point range in the second half. Overall, in the second half, Michigan shot 17%. And so I think, again, with Kata Bates-Diop and what he can do, it's 6'8", but with a wingspan of a 7-footer, he's a guy that can score down low. He can shoot from outside. He can be a double-figure rebounder and not only block but affect shots on the defensive end. And you just really see him playing at the level that last year's coaching staff talked about he had been playing with prior to the start of last season, before the stress fracture in his left leg. So he's a guy that really has shown what kind of difficult matchup he can be for opponents. And it keeps people from, you know, it allows more opportunities for Jayshon Tate. And, you know, and then I think now Caleb Wesson is a low post player. He's kind of a little bit of a poor man's Jarrett Sullinger with the way he's played. So I think that's given Ohio State some balanced options on offense.
Paul, if you can just kind of, because we haven't really talked a ton about the Buckeye basketballers or the Big Ten, really, because of all of our focus on the football side of things. Michigan State is number two in the country right now in the AP and in the coaches poll, outside of the obvious, which is Sparty. Can you size up the talent in the Big Ten and what the Buckeyes are, you know, how you would rank them, if you will? And I'm not saying specifically with a number, but where you find them in terms of the tiers going into this season?
Well, I think, Bob, it really is a conference that's top-heavy with Michigan State and probably Purdue right after that. I mean, this is potentially as loaded a team as Tom Izzo has had in quite some time. And I think people were surprised that Miles Bridges didn't go to the NBA, and he came back. And he's just a guy that, really can be a tough matchup for people. I think Purdue, because of the experience they have with the outside shooting of a guy like Dakota Mathias, and then two big guys in Harms and then Jacob Haas, that really make it tough for people down low. From there, it's a little bit of a mismatch. I think Minnesota's a team that really intrigues people. They think they could be a good team with the returning experience they have up front. Northwestern, believe it or not, because, you know, coming off their first ever NCAA tournament bid and again bringing experience back, is a team that I think people have their eye on. But from there, it's kind of a little bit of a reach. Wisconsin is down and struggling, and Wisconsin that came up, they've got a couple of key players now that are going to be out for a while with an injury. And Ohio State's probably in the middle to the bottom portion of that. But again, I think because of the fact that there's some unknowns with the new coaching staff, really only one experienced scholarship point guard. You know, there just wasn't really a lot of idea how they were going to translate from this coaching transition into success on the court. Now I think there's a little more optimism about what they might be able to do and where they might be able to finish in the order in the conference. And I know I saw something earlier today where somebody has projected them as being an NCAA tournament team. Now, it's way too early for that. But I think the schedule's favorable in the fact that they only get Michigan State once, and it's in Columbus. They only play Wisconsin once, and they've already played them and beaten them, even though they're down. And I can't remember, I think Maryland. I think they only get Maryland once, and they get them at home. So I think there's a little favorable part of the schedule. But I think there's still a lot of wait and see about this Ohio State team.
Paul, is the Big Ten in a downward trend at this moment? And I say that only because of what, generally speaking, are meaningless. But, you know, when you look at the polls that I just quoted and mentioned Michigan State being second, and you mentioned Purdue, which is 17th, they're the only two Big Ten teams, unless my eyes are deceiving me, in the top 25, and that's kind of a startling thing for me. So, does that mean very much to you? And do you think that is the Big Ten not getting enough respect nationally? Or are they getting about the amount of respect that they deserve based on what these teams look like?
Probably what they deserve right now, and I think it may be down, Bob, but only in the sense that you've got teams that lost so much talent. Wisconsin being a prime example, Iowa being another one. You know, Wisconsin's got a very, very talented post player and Ethan Happ, but, you know, they lose guys like Nigel Hayes and Bronson Koenig, as well as Vito Brown. And, you know, that takes away a lot of what was around Ethan Happ to make them, you know, for the last few years, one of the top teams in the conference. I think certainly, you know, Michigan, who still looked at very highly regarded, but, you know, they lost some key players from last year when you think about Zach Walton. So, I think it's just a matter of their teams that lost key people and not knowing what is going to be in those positions to fill them, with the exception of a Michigan State and Minnesota. And even though Purdue lost Caleb Swanigan, you knew that they were still with Jacob Haas. They still were going to be a team that was going to be tough to deal with on the backboard. So it may be down, yes, but I think that's just because we're seeing the transition of players who left other teams.
And, Paul, Jim Cushion's got one final question for you. Jimmy, go ahead.
Yeah, and looking at that and randomly, guys, just an FYI on the schedule part, which I think is, you know, the way this Big Ten feels like it's shaping up. You guys mentioned Michigan State and whatnot. Yeah, Purdue, they only get them once. That's in West Lafayette. And Minnesota, who dropped out of the rankings, they only have to play them once as well. That's on the road. So I would say it's nice to not have to play those types of teams multiple times. Yes, indeed, Maryland only once. That's at home early January. So when you look at the way it's shaping up, and you mentioned it's way too, and I agree, guys, it's way, way too early to talk about NCAA tournament, but given where this program was this past offseason, end of the Thad Mata era, you know, bringing in Chris Holtmann, felt like a transition, would you call this season a success down the line if they at least somehow squeak out and make an NIT, forget NCAA, but if they can make something like the NIT, I would consider that a successful season because I didn't see that on the horizon for this year.
I would agree with you, Jim. I think, and that Minnesota game, by the way, is going to be in Madison Square Garden in New York.
Oh,
Minnesota,
okay.
They gave up their home game to be part of that basketball hockey doubleheader that they have every year there. But I would agree that making the NIT, which Ohio State didn't do last year, if that were what happened, that would be a big success. But again, this is the thing that is going to be important to watch with this team, and it's what got them in trouble in a couple of games that they've lost. Teams that'll put pressure on them, teams that'll put a zone on them. that's where this Ohio State team's got to grow up. It's a little challenged when it comes to facing those kind of things. I mean, CJ Jackson and Andrew Dockich in the losses against Butler and against Gonzaga and against Clemson have shown their susceptibility. So that's where you look for them hopefully to grow up and, you know, really be able to help this basketball team if they're able to do that.
Paul Keel's voice of the Buckeyes giving us a little bit of a preview of the Big Ten schedule, the Big Ten teams, the strengths, and, of course, the Buckeyes themselves, who are off now for what? About 5 days off, not back in action until the 16th against App State. Is that right?
Yeah, Saturday. And this is final exam week, too. So this is where you generally always see that gap, Bob, to be able to have those players. And which is kind of a welcome relief when you get the things we talked about with the early conference games, mm-hmm. The quick turnaround after they had been in Portland playing the three games in that tournament out there. So, yeah, they've got final exams this week. So that's where typically you see them go Saturday to Saturday.
All right, Paul. Well, listen, enjoy your break, too, then, since you don't have to call any games until Saturday. And you don't have any exams or anything facing you, do you?
No, not that I'm aware of.
All right. Paul, thanks so much for the time. As always, we'll check in with you again next week.
All right, guys. Take care.
Thanks very much. Paul Keels is the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. Buckeyes do play App State on Saturday, as he mentioned, at 6 p.m. as they continue their first place, obviously, with their two wins in the conference, tied with Purdue and Michigan State at 2-0. They're 8-3 overall on the season thus far. Okay, going to get out here and get a bottom of the hour local sports center. We're going to come back and talk some NFL football because there are a lot of issues to discuss, including the Cleveland Walking Clowns, as they found yet another way to lose a football game, a 21-7 lead they had in the fourth quarter against the Brett Hundley-led Green Bay Packers, and they found a way to give it all back and then lose in overtime on a very rough play by Toledo's own Deshaun Kizer. But this game is so much more than his interception in overtime. We're going to talk about that with Maniloff, as well as so many of the other top NFL stories as we recap that. Coming up next, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It's unfortunate. Our guys, they fight hard. They do a lot of good things, and we do things that don't give us a chance to finish football games. You know, we started this game pretty well, did some good things defensively, offensively, moved the ball. I thought Deshaun early in the game played extremely well, did some really good things. Still some plays I'm sure he wished he had back. But then again, in the fourth quarter, you know, you can just see when you need it the most, that's when you got to make plays in the National Football League, and that's what I told the football team.
That's what Hugh Jackson told the football team, but the football team doesn't make plays because the football team doesn't know how to make plays because the football team is indeed the worst football team in the history of the sport of professional football. 1-28 in their last 29 games. No one has ever done that before. 4-46 in their last 50 games. No one has ever done that before. And if I'm John Dorsey, the new GM, I'm watching that dumpster fire yesterday and I am walking right back out the door from whence I came. How about it? A little NFL talk now with our good friend Dennis Maniloff, who covers those clowns out of Cleveland for the good people at Cleveland.com and the Cleveland Plain Dealer. D-Man, what's going on? How are you?
What's up, Bob France? Thanks for having me on.
The dream is still alive, the dream of an 0-16 season to match the only other 0-16 season ever in NFL history, the 2008 Detroit Lions. But I got a little nervous there for a while, thinking they might actually end the winless streak and win a game. How silly was I? I should have had a little more confidence. Dennis, did you believe going into the fourth quarter with a 14-point lead that the Browns were about to win a football game?
I learned you never, ever think the Browns are going to win a game, that they have to be winning when the clock shows zero before you believe that. I did think, though, if they got it to three scores somehow in the fourth quarter, that the Packers would not overcome it because they didn't have A-Rod. But, you know, the Browns only, I say in quotes, had a 14-point lead, a two-score game. So as long as it was a two-score game, I thought it was realistic. Once it got to 21-14, I said the Packers are going to find a way to win this somehow, you know, by hook or by crook.
And what was it? How did they find a way to win it? Because, you know what, Dennis, you know, we're sitting here, and I do this not because we're in Toledo, home of Deshaun Kizer, but in reality, I mean, I looked at Twitter the minute he threw that obviously errant, terrible decision, falling back off of both, not even back on one leg, but falling backwards off both feet, on his way down and threw that ball. His arm got hit and went up for grabs and was picked in overtime. And Twitter immediately killed him. It's because of Kaiser. This guy sucks. We got to draft a quarterback, blah, blah, blah. And that may be true. Maybe they do need to draft a quarterback number one overall. But they were putting it on him as if he gave up a 65-yard punt return near the end of regulation that set up the game-tying touchdown, as if he didn't cover the guy out of the backfield, as if he, you know, was responsible for personally blowing a 21-7 lead. There were a lot of things that went wrong for the Cleveland Browns, and it wasn't all just DeShone Kizer because he made a bad decision in a panic move, basically a panicky decision, I suppose, in the first possession of overtime.
All right, you're absolutely right. Let me answer the original question you had. You know, how was it that they lost the game? I look at it existentially and then on the micro level. Existentially, they lost it because it's what losing teams do. Losing teams lose games. That's what they specialize in. And nobody does it better than the Browns. They figure out ways to lose. This is why I've constantly told people, listen, you can't just sit here and fritter away seasons and automatically expect to flip the switch and win games. It is an art form. You have to learn how to win. And the longer you go without knowing how to win, the longer the rebuild or the build, and the longer the build takes, the more injuries can happen and the more rosters can change. And all of a sudden you have to scrap the original build and start over. So that on the existential level, on the macro level, they lost because it's what they do. On the micro level, when I look at all the plays in that game, I pin it on the 55-yard punt return. You're absolutely right, Bob. That's inexcusable. Special teams, in my opinion, no matter how young your roster is, no matter how inexperienced, there's no excuse for bad special teams. And the Browns, year in and year out, almost weekly, do something stupid on special teams that cost their team dearly. And this was the case. You had to tackle the man right then and there. I'm not guaranteeing a win, but I'm pretty sure the Browns, would have won the game if they would have held that punt returner to less than 10 yards, let's say. Instead, he goes 65. They get the quick score to tie it, and you know the rest. So, and regarding Kaiser, I thought he was easily on his way to his best game of his rookie season. I had him graded in the A to A minus range all the way up until overtime. I said to my fiance, all it's going to take for me to drop his grade is one dumb play. I said, if he makes a dumb play, I'm going to have to drop his grade. Otherwise, he's looking at his first A or A minus of the season. And he made a dumb play in OT, and it cost his team dearly. So I dropped him all the way to a C plus because it was just a mistake that was impossible to ignore.
Dennis Manilow breaking down the Browns' 13th consecutive loss of the season. They are a three-game losing streak, or a continuation of, I suppose, away from tying the Lions' 2008 winless record and extending the worst stretch of football ever played in the history of the National Football League. Jim Cushion's got a question for you, Dennis.
Yeah, first and foremost, guys, what's going on, Dennis? First and foremost, I was thinking the same thing, you know, at the end of that game yesterday. They find new ways to lose, and it made me think of the old Casey Stengel quote from when he was managing the Mets in the early 60s. I'm literally going to quote him word for word, just replace Mets with Browns. Come see my amazing Browns. I've been in this game 100 years, and I see new ways to lose I never knew existed before. That said, second week we've seen Josh Gordon out there for this team, and you can already tell the difference at times. His touchdown grab was one of those athletic kind of plays that seemingly nobody else in the receiving corps can make. Obviously, he was, I thought, a big reason why they were ahead when they were ahead. Talk to me from what you've seen, Dennis, of now 2 weeks with Josh Gordon back in the lineup.
Well, he's no question a difference maker. I liked what I saw early from Gordon, and obviously as the game went on, there wasn't as much Gordon action. Either, you know, he was getting mugged or he wasn't getting open or Kaiser wasn't looking to him. But in any case, his production fell off significantly after the first few series. But that said, he is a difference maker. You can tell. He's a specimen out there, the strength, the speed, the whole deal, the hands. So it's exciting to see him back. But I will say this, Cushion, Bob. I mean, people that are expecting Josh Gordon to come back as, you know, humble guy, it's just unrealistic. He's not going to change who he is. I mean, he's already been in this Twitter exchange with the Packers cornerbacks that he couldn't carry my jock. You know, that's just who Josh Gordon is. I mean, you got to get used to that. To me, I'm not expecting some guy to, you know, walk out there with angel's wings every Sunday and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry for what I've done." He's going to carry himself the way he has. You just hope that he stays clean, you know, off the field. And if he does, then you know you're going to get a productive player more often than not.
Why do you think he was so less productive as the game went on, though?
Well, there was specific questions were asked about it. And you know, the Packers changed their coverage. I want to say specifically McCarthy was saying something about rotating the safety over. They kind of shadow doubled Gordon a little bit, which I think changed Kaiser's optics to a degree. There's that. Some of it was, and I'm not making excuses for Josh Gordon, but I mean, you watch some of the plays, including the play that turned into the horrible play by Kaiser. His original look is slant to Gordon, and I can't remember his name. I think it was Randall, the corner, absolutely grabs Gordon off the line and bear hugs him after the initial read. But Kaiser still had the ball, and he was still looking toward Gordon. And Randall had two hands around Gordon. So there were times where he was getting one time a corner had his arm pinned to his side. So there was a lot of physicality that was going uncalled. But I think a lot of it had to do with the Packers changing their defensive scheme to account for Gordon.
Dennis Mandeloff joining us, talking a little bit of the Browns' 13th consecutive loss of this season. Real quick, going back to the hiring, because I didn't talk to you after it happened, of John Dorsey, your thoughts on whether or not he will be able to do any better than anybody else has done since 1999. How do you feel about him not being able to choose his own coach, since Jimmy Haslam has said Hugh Jackson will continue to report to him, Haslam, as opposed to the new GM, and he is staying on for a third year? Is this going to work?
It's alarming to me, Bob. The whole arrangement, the whole Hugh Jackson thing is very strange and alarming. That paradigm, when was the last time that worked, where a GM inherited a coach and anything good came out of it? I don't see why or how it is that Jimmy Haslam recognizes that he desperately needs the quote-unquote football guy in that position of, you know, talent evaluation and all that, and yet he ties one hand behind his back and doesn't let him pick his own coach. I mean, that is a very uncomfortable situation. And I get, you know, Dorsey at the time was unemployed, obviously, or he wouldn't have been employed by the Browns. So maybe there's a little bit of a desperation for Dorsey to get back in the mix, and he also sees the landscape of the draft picks and the capital that had been built up for 2018 specifically. So Dorsey's not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. He's not going to hold out against Haslam and say, "Well, you're offering me the job, but I'm going to make a demand here. I want to hire my own coach." So he goes along with it and says, "All right, you want me to, you know, sit here while Jackson remains the coach? Okay, fine. As long as I can be the GM and as long as I can, you know, have the final say on the roster, I'll go along with it." But I just don't understand. I don't get why Haslam would tether Jackson to Dorsey. All Haslam had to do when he hired Dorsey was say, "Look, we put everybody on notice. We got rid of Sashi. We brought in Dorsey. What we're going to do is we're going to evaluate for the remainder of the season. All bets are off, and we'll make our decision at the end of the season." He didn't have to say at that moment in time last week, "Well, I'm bringing Jackson back, and we're not only are we bringing him back, we expect him to be the coach for years and years and years." Why do you have to do that? That's an unforced error to me, because now if the Browns get boat raced the next three games and they're 0-16, how comfortable do you think John Dorsey's going to be bringing back a 1-31 head coach?
It's a great point. That is exactly what I was talking about, and that's one of the reasons why I've said a million times, not that it, you know, means anything because he's the owner, but the only guy that really needs to be fired here is the guy in charge of this dumpster fire. and that is Jimmy Haslam. He needs to fire himself. He needs to sell the football team, but be that as it may. Let me get a few other issues in here NFL-wise for you, Dennis Manilov. Start with Carson Wentz. Now that he's done, the ACL is torn. The Eagles are done, I believe, as the favorite to go to the Super Bowl from the NFC. But can you trust the second-best record in the NFC, Case Keenum, or Minnesota, I should say, to get there with Case Keenum, or is it just a wide-open crapshoot as to who's coming out now?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to, first of all, tough to absorb the Wentz thing, because Wentz was playing so well, and obviously it's strange. I don't know how many minutes Wentz ever has spent in Cleveland, but we have a connection to him because we always say, you know, he should have been ours. So a lot of people around here follow Wentz's career, so Cleveland fans feel the pain of Eagles fans when Wentz goes down by extension. So unfortunate for him. Eagles, it's tough to think that they're going to go deep with Nick Foles, but he has won games in the past. I think he had one game in his career where he threw 7 TDs against the Raiders. So he's capable. It's not like you're bringing in, a stiff at quarterback. But as far as the NFC goes...
Well, and you know what? One other thought on that, Dennis, just real quick on the Eagles to buttress what you just said. This isn't like it's the Packers, where it's Aaron Rodgers and really a weak roster. The Eagles are a very good, well-balanced team in a lot of places. Defensively, they can run the ball. Certainly Carson Wentz is their best player and their key, but... You know, it's not like this is, hey, Rodgers goes down so the entire team stinks. If Foles can just play adequately, they still have a shot.
Yes, and Foles has played well in stretches in his NFL career, and I think his high point was with the Eagles at one point. So, I think the Eagles are going to be as good of a bet as any out of the NFC to come out of it, because I don't see anybody else that blows your doors off. You know, I would have thought that, for example, the Seahawks would be revved up and ready to rumble, and they go to Jacksonville and lose. Now, granted, Jacksonville's okay. They're a playoff team right now, but they're not a juggernaut to me. That's a team that, if I'm going to fear the Seahawks in the NFC, that's a team the Seahawks win, or a team they beat, a game right. They win. So they don't win that, so I'm not sure about the Seahawks. The Rams have holes. I mean, they've come a long way in 1 year. I think it's unrealistic to expect them to go, all the way to the Super Bowl this year. You keep moving around. Dallas is problematic. Maybe if they get Zeke back, they can feel real good about themselves. But I do think it's open for the most part. If I had to put, here's a team that I wouldn't count out. The Carolina Panthers. You know, I still have respect for that team, what they've accomplished, Ron Rivera, Cam Newton.
Can't trust him. Can't trust Cam Newton. No way.
Well, but, he's been to a Super Bowl, and I just
think... I know, but he's just not that good. He's just not that good anymore as a quarterback. I mean, 17 touchdowns this year, 12 interceptions. He's only thrown for 2,700 yards. He's only at a 60% completion clip, well below the top quarterbacks in the league,
Is there a team you would definitively put over, for example, the Panthers? You say, well, the Vikings. Well, the Vikings have Keenum, and they just lost to the Panthers. So I don't think, and I'm not saying the Panthers are all that. I get what you're saying about Newton to a degree. I'm saying the NFC is wide open in large part because of the Wentz injury. I think there's a handful of teams that could emerge.
Briefly, how much of a factor?
Any one of them is going to lose to the Patriots, by the way.
How much of a factor will the Packers be in this now that they won yesterday, of course, over the Browns, and it put them plus 500? And now it looks like Rodgers will come back, if not this week, then next week. I mean, is there a chance they are part of that group that can, anybody can come out of?
You never count the Packers out when they have Aaron Rodgers. I mean, it is incredible to think about that Browns collapse. If the Browns don't collapse, I don't know exactly what was said publicly, but it seemed to me that Rodgers, they might shut him down for the remainder of the year if the Packers had lost to the Browns.
That's how I thought of it too, yes.
Right. So, the Browns, who knows what will happen the remainder of the season, but how wild would it be if the Browns contributed to the Packers, making the playoffs by having Rodgers come back and do what he does in the final week? Nobody closes regular seasons better than A-Rod does when his team's back's against the wall. So I would never count out the Packers. And here's the thing. If they get in, they will had to have been super hot to get there. They will had to have gone on one of those runs, because in order to get in, you pretty much have to win out. So at that point, when the playoffs start, the Packers would be one of the hottest teams in the NFL. So absolutely you would not count them out if they get in.
Dennis, you said that whoever it is will lose to the Patriots anyway. Are you completely discounting the 11-2 Steelers and all of that firepower that was on display again last night?
Yes, I am, and that's probably a mistake. I just think that the Patriots are such a well-oiled machine. They're the best organization, one of the best organizations in all of pro sports, and certainly in the NFL. They're the gold standard. I think what happens with the Patriots, they're able to plug and play. They get guys in when guys get hurt. They perform at a higher level. Now, the Steelers, unbelievable credit to them, and as painful as it is for me from Cleveland to say it, but, you know, Ryan Shazier out. A devastating injury, devastating all the way around, emotionally, everything. Terrible, terrible, terrible situation. They're able to overcome that, you know, and win. They lose other guys. Le'Veon Bell gets hurt last night. They overcome that. So the Steelers are a team that is able to overcome adversity. They don't make excuses. But I think, you know, when it's all said and done, Brady and Belichick continue to get it done.
Dennis Mantloff with some thoughts on the NFL and the Clowns continuing the worst stretch in the history of professional football. Dennis, always a pleasure, my friend. I want to talk to you about the MVP race maybe next week, because everybody said that the MVP was had a season ended yesterday, and I still can't figure out why Carson Wentz is that guy over Brady when Brady leads him in virtually every category except TD passes. But that, and maybe for the first time ever, a wide receiver should be considered for that award, because Antonio Brown, as he continued last night, doing just remarkable things. But we'll talk more about that next time around, Dennis. Thank you, my man.
Thank you, buddy.
You got it. All right, music playing means that's kind of like the Pavlovian bell, because when you hear that music, it means that Mike Miller is salivating and waiting behind the microphone for drive time. So that's what's coming up next. Stay where you are for Mike and drive time, and we're back tomorrow afternoon for the next extravaganza. Have a good one. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.